to throw his support behind a potentially lucrative line of business that Leisner and Andrea Vella were developing in Malaysia. Cohn had set up a special cross-divisional unit to make money from sovereign wealth funds, co-investing with them in private equity deals, devising hedging strategies, or simply raising capital. This business line was colloquially termed monetizing the state inside Goldman, and was a major focus inside the bank. Cohn started to travel regularly to Southeast Asia, where he had high-level meetings about co-investing with Singapore's powerful Temasek Holdings Investment Fund. He viewed 1MDB very much in this vein, although the fund shared almost no similarities with Temasek, a professionally run entity. The backing of a domineering and powerful personality like Cohn afforded significant cover to those involved in the 1MDB business and drowned out the voices of those who were uncomfortable with the plans to raise billions of dollars for the fund. David Ryan, president of Goldman in Asia, was among those urging caution. He had visited 1MDB's staff in Malaysia and came away with concerns over its plans to take on so much debt and the inexperience of its management, none of whom seemed to have overseen multi-billion dollar investments before. The potential deal wound its way through five Goldman committees that look at financial and legal risk. One of the main points of debate was the role of Joe Low, whose exact position baffled some Goldman executives. The bank had turned down Low for a private banking account in Switzerland, so it could not formally enter into a major deal that involved him. One Goldman executive, in an email to colleagues on March 27th, acknowledged Low was a 1MDB operator or intermediary in Malaysia. But in conversations with Goldman staff around the same time, Leisner denied Low was involved in the deal. Such middlemen were considered highly risky at American banks because of the possibility they were receiving bribes, a violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that could lead to a big fine. Yet Leisner, who had traveled with Low to meet Sheikh Mansour, must have been fully aware the Malaysian was directing the show. In this period, the German banker would travel all over the world to meet Low, whether in Kuala Lumpur, Hong Kong, or Switzerland. Low's plan was for 1MDB to sell the bonds quickly and secretively via a private placement. Typically, most companies issuing bonds prefer to do so through a public issuance, in which the bank arranging the deal canvasses a wide range of investors. Through this process, called book building, banks with access to a large network of investors can reduce a company's cost of funds. Investors in a private placement, by contrast, typically big institutions like pension funds or hedge funds, demand higher returns. The advantage is that companies can raise money quickly and without getting credit ratings from big agencies like Moody's and Standard & Poor's. The process also involved much less scrutiny, just how Low liked it. The 1MDB fund had agreed to pay $2.7 billion for power plants owned by Malaysian billionaire Ananda Krishnan's Tanjong Energy Holdings, the first of a series of acquisitions it planned to make in the sector. To give the deal a veneer of authenticity, 1MDB needed an independent valuation of the plants. Leisner stepped in, asking Lazard if it could oblige. The U.S. bank agreed to take a look, but its bankers crunched the numbers and couldn't figure out why 1MDB was willing to pay $2.7 billion for the suite of plants, which were located in Malaysia, as well as Egypt, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and the UAE. The deal seemed favorable to Tanjong, especially given that its power sale agreement with the Malaysian state would soon run out, handing the government leverage to achieve a bargain price. Lazard believed the whole deal smelled of political corruption. It was common in Malaysia for the government to award sweetheart deals to companies in return for kickbacks and political financing. That was what Lazard thought was going on, and so it pulled out. With no other choice, Goldman instead became an advisor to 1MDB on the purchase, as well as helping the fund raise the capital. The bank provided a valuation range that justified 1MDB paying $2.7 billion for the plants. Leisner was at his most charming as he tried to cajole members of 1MDB's board of directors to accept Goldman's terms for selling the bonds. sitting opposite the Goldman banker in a room at the fund's downtown Kuala Lumpur offices, just a few weeks after Leisner's meeting in Abu Dhabi. Some of the board members looked skeptical. Goldman was preparing to launch what it internally dubbed Project Magnolia, a plan to sell $1.75 billion in 10-year bonds for the 1MDB fund. But some board members were alarmed by what Leisner had informed them. Goldman would likely make $190 million from its part in the deal, or 11% of the bond's value. This was an outrageous sum, even more than Goldman had made on the Sarawak transaction the year before, and way above the normal fee of $1 million for such work. The banker defended Goldman's profit by pointing out that 1MDB would make big returns in a future IPO of the power assets, all without putting down any money of its own. "Look at your number." "Not at our number," he said cajolingly. Working together with Andrea Vella, the Goldman executive who headed up the debt and structured finance business in the region, Leisner had arranged for a rerun of the Sarawak bond. As last time, the PFI trading desk would buy the entire issue, using its massive capital, and later find investors. That meant Goldman would be taking on all the risk, and 1MDB would get the money quickly. Despite some questions, the board, filled mainly with Najib loyalists, was ultimately a rubber stamp, and it wasn't going to mount a serious attempt to stop this plan in its tracks. Even at Goldman, some bankers, including David Ryan, considered the bank's likely profit excessive. Alex Turnbull, a Hong Kong-based Goldman banker whose father, Malcolm Turnbull, would later become Australia's prime minister, also raised concerns internally. Turnbull wasn't involved in the deal, but he knew how bond markets worked, and he sent an email to colleagues expressing disbelief about Goldman's profits. The email led to a reprimand from Goldman's compliance department, while Turnbull's boss told him to keep his mouth shut if he ever wanted to get promoted. He left the bank almost 2 years later for reasons unrelated to 1MDB. Internally, Leisner, backed by Vella, defended the returns as commensurate with the risk Goldman was taking by buying the entire $1.7 billion in bonds. The 1MDB fund was paying most of its fee to Goldman by selling the bonds at a discount, and the bank would make its money if they could find investors willing to pay a higher price. But the face value, that is, the undiscounted price, was still high enough to yield 6% annually to an investor, a high return given the guarantee from IPIC, and an inviting proposition at a time when rates in Western economies and Japan were hovering close to zero. In fact, Goldman already had lined up mutual funds in South Korea, China, and the Philippines to buy the bonds. The sale was handled quietly, and one Goldman employee was told to keep all correspondence about the bond off email. If word got out Goldman already had buyers, its profits would not seem justified. There was another reason Goldman didn't need to worry. Tanjong, the seller of the power plants, had itself agreed to subscribe to a significant portion of the offering, according to the prospectus, a document Goldman bankers had drawn up to detail the bond for investors. The 1MDB fund had paid Tanjong a favorable price for its assets, and now the company itself was getting bonds with an attractive yield. In return, companies linked to Ananda Krishnan secretly made donations of $170 million to 1MDB's charity arm. Soon after, in its financial accounts, the fund was forced to impair, or write off, $400 million of the value of the plants on its books, an admission it had overpaid. Lazard had been right to mistrust the high valuation of Tanjong's assets, but Goldman missed what was going on. Goldman's internal committees, set up to catch fraud, had failed in their job. Those arguing in favor of the deal cited the imprimatur of Malaysia's government and the role of Prime Minister Najib in 1MDB. But there was another, unspoken, reason to make this happen. The profits would make this one of Goldman's biggest paydays of the year. The stewards of Goldman, Only a few years after the mortgage meltdown and promises of more upright behavior, were once again failing to uphold principles. The whole notion of monetizing the state in countries without rule of law and sophisticated investors risked costing taxpayers in poor places for the benefit of Wall Street. Goldman already had gotten entangled in a bad situation with the Libyan Investment Authority. Now the bank appeared to be overcharging a client in Malaysia whose willingness to pay above the odds was illogical. A series of red flags, from the involvement of Joe Lowe to the unusual decision to obtain a guarantee from the fund of another country, to 1MDB's willingness to overpay for the power plants, were all overlooked. On May 22, 2012, just a day after Goldman had deposited the proceeds from the $1.75 billion bond into the bank account of 1MDB's energy subsidiary, $576 million of that amount flowed to the account of a British Virgin Islands company called Aabar Investments Limited. This company was meant to look like Aabar Investments PJS, a subsidiary of IPIC. 1MDB would later claim, in its audited financial statements, that this was a payment to compensate the Abu Dhabi Fund for its guarantee of the bond. But this was an imitation firm, set up 2 months earlier, and the directors of the lookalike Aabar were Al Kubaisi and Al Husseini, the chairman and chief executive of the real fund. It was as if the chief executive of General Electric or another blue-chip American firm had set up a fake company to look like General Electric to engage in off-the-books fraudulent behavior while still enjoying the cover of a well-known name. It was a move straight out of Joe Lowe's playbook. When he was just starting out, Lowe had set up lookalike companies to make it appear he had the backing of Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds. This time, the stakes were much higher. It was a ruse devised by Joe Lowe and Al Kubaisi to take more money from 1MDB. As a further level of security, the pair had arranged for the money to flow via Switzerland-based Falcon Private Bank, which Aabar had bought from American insurance conglomerate AIG. Al Kubaisi had snapped it up when AIG was in trouble during the financial crisis and renamed it Falcon Bank after the Gulf's famous hunting bird. Switzerland was under pressure from the United States to clamp down on money laundering, but Al Kubaisi had control of his own Swiss bank. Consequently, Falcon's bankers raised no red alerts, despite huge flows of money that would normally have tripped compliance alarms. 5 months later, Goldman launched Project Maximus, buying another $1.75 billion in bonds to finance 1MDB's acquisition of power plants from the Malaysian casino and plantations conglomerate Genting Group. Again, the fund paid a high price, and like Tanjong, Genting made payments to a Najib-linked charity. This time, $790.3 million disappeared into the lookalike Aabar. David Ryan, president of Goldman's Asia operations, argued to lower the fee on the second bond, given how easy it had been to sell the first round. But he was overruled by senior executives, including Gary Cohn. While Goldman was working on the deal, Ryan was effectively sidelined. The bank brought in a veteran banker, Mark Schwartz, a proponent of the 1MDB business, as chairman in Asia, a post senior to Ryan's. Goldman earned a little less than the first deal, making $114 million. Still an enormous windfall. For bringing in the business, Leisner was paid a salary and bonuses in 2012 of more than $10 million, making him one of the bank's top remunerated employees. For 3 years now, the banker had orbited around Lowe, hoping for a major payoff. He'd gone out of his way to help Lowe find bankers for valuations, and even visited him in a Swiss clinic. But Leisner knew better than to acknowledge Lowe's secret role at the fund. What exactly the German banker knew about the fraud remains unclear. Did Leisner suspect Lowe was taking from the till? With such huge money at stake, perhaps Leisner convinced himself this situation was normal. Weren't there always unsavory fixers in Asian business deals? Wasn't Asia just a morass of corruption anyway? In October, Toby Watson, head of Goldman's PFI desk in Asia, made partner. It was a good year also for Blankfein, Goldman's CEO, who was paid $21 million, still well off his pre-crisis record of $68 million in 2007, but a major payday nonetheless. Blankfein had developed other lines of business for Goldman, delivering a $7.5 billion profit that year. But the developments in Malaysia signified a big strategic win for the chief executive. Leisner didn't want to shout from the rooftops about it, though, instead acting as if the bonds were a secret. When a senior Goldman colleague in the region circulated the profits internally, he testily asked for the information to be kept tight. As the colleague put it, there was a real sense you didn't want to draw attention to this. Joe Lowe had executed his second major heist. Unlike the first phase in 2009, with Petro Saudi as his partner, the Malaysian had laid out this plan in minute detail. 3 years earlier, Lowe had sought to do a big sovereign wealth deal, put himself in the middle of the money flows, and perhaps earn a broker fee. Events moved quickly, and the conspirators saw their chance to take money. This time around, Lowe carefully laid the groundwork. Instead of an unknown Saudi company as a partner, he had roped in IPIC, one of the largest sovereign wealth funds on the planet. Al-Kubaisi was an infinitely more powerful figure than Prince Turki, a layabout seventh son of the Saudi king. Back in 2009, Lowe's excuses about the money flows varied, as if he were making them up on the fly. The Malaysian also took a huge risk, sending the cash to a Seychelles company he had set up. This time, Lowe and Al-Kubaisi took much greater precautions, sending cash to a company that looked like an Abu Dhabi sovereign wealth fund and was controlled by Al-Kubaisi. Known to only a handful of insiders at the time, the money fanned out from the lookalike Abar to a small set of beneficiaries connected to the deal. In total, $1.4 billion was diverted. Here was the capital needed to make the Wolf of Wall Street, to pay off Malaysian voters, and to finance ever more exuberant parties and gambling. Al-Kubaisi was rewarded handsomely for his role. Soon after 1MDB raised its second bond and funds flowed to the lookalike Abar, a stream of money, eventually totaling more than $400 million, moved to an account controlled by Al-Kubaisi's company, Vasco Investment Services, at Edmund de Rothschild Bank in Luxembourg. From here, Al-Kubaisi would buy mansions in the United States, on both coasts. But he was also careful to ensure his patron, Sheikh Mansour, was taken care of. As the Goldman bonds came together, engineers from the shipbuilding firm Lursen in Bremen, Germany, were putting the final touches to Topaz, Sheikh Mansour's 482-foot yacht, which cost more than $500 million and was as large as a floating hotel, with two helicopter pads and eight decks. Al-Kubaisi handled the financing for the Topaz, raising a large loan from Deutsche Bank that required payments of 6.4 million euros a month, a considerable outlay. One of the first payments Al-Kubaisi made from Vasco, after receiving money from 1MDB, was a 6.4 million euro transfer to Deutsche Bank, an installment on the Topaz loan. He'd later pay a total of $166 million of the payments, with funds from Vasco. In late April, as Goldman prepared 1MDB's first bond issue, some 100,000 anti-corruption protesters poured out into the streets of Kuala Lumpur. From the sky, the city center was awash in yellow, the color of the demonstrators' t-shirts. For some time, anger among regular middle-class folk, teachers, office workers, lawyers, students, about everyday corruption had been rising. The demonstrators brandished anti-graft signboards. Some called for electoral reform. Others held up caricatures of Rosma, who had become the symbol of Prime Minister Najib's kleptocratic regime. How had she paid for her jewels, people wanted to know. As the swell of protesters tried to make their way to Independence Square, a grassy area at the heart of the city, riot police blocked their way. Late in the afternoon, as the marchers pushed forward, security forces met them with tear gas and water cannons. Suddenly, a police officer drove a vehicle into a group of demonstrators, injuring two people. The crowd reacted violently, dragging the officer out and turning the car upside down before smashing in its windows. Scores of protesters were injured, some severely, over the next few hours. The battle lines had been drawn for elections due the following year. The protesters knew nothing of what Low had carried out at 1MDB, but corruption in Malaysia already was eating away at the nation's social fabric. From vote buying by UMNO, the ruling party, at election time, to the regular backhanded payments by businesses to win government contracts. While middle-class Malaysians dealt with stagnating wages, Malaysia's elite was accruing greater wealth, and it was fueling discontent. In 2006, a group of opposition politicians, lawyers, and anti-corruption activists had started a movement called Bersih. The Malay word meant clean, seeking reforms to ensure fair elections. In 2007 and 2011, Bersih protesters wearing trademark yellow t-shirts had taken to the streets, clashing with police. But nothing had changed, and the Bersih organizers had called this protest as a last-ditch attempt to ensure clean elections, which were due to be held in mid-2013. They hoped this demonstration, the largest democratic protest in Malaysia's history, would force the government to listen. Instead, it ended in rancor and division. Yet it was so much worse than the public knew. Low had taken graft to new levels, risking Malaysia's financial stability. The 1MDB fund's debt stood at a whopping $7 billion, and it had few assets to show for the huge borrowings. Most of the money had been diverted, and the fund had crashed to a $30 million net loss in its latest financial year. But most of these details were kept secret. It was even hard to get a copy of the fund's financial report. Prime Minister Najib had envisioned 1MDB as a way to create jobs and as a slush fund to build his popularity with all Malaysians. Instead, it had become a cesspit of graft. With his popularity sinking, Najib would soon double down on his bet on Low, backing the 1MDB fund's push to take on even more debt in a bid to win the upcoming elections. His actions would send 1MDB even deeper into a death spiral. Low hoped the planned IPO of 1MDB's power assets would stabilize the fund and hide the growing thefts. A risky strategy, to say the least. But the Malaysian didn't dwell much on the future. This was only government money, after all, and he still had the confidence of Najib, who had the power to write off debt. From another perspective, Low had replenished his stock of capital, and now had the firepower to push ahead with constructing a Hollywood empire. He was on the cusp of entering the most reckless period of his young life. Part 3. Empire. Chapter 27. Making Busta His Bitch. Aboard the Serene, French Riviera, July 2012. As the helicopter approached the landing pad, nestled in the bow of the 440-foot superyacht Serene, Joe Lowe was in high spirits. He was about to fly off to Monaco with an entourage of women for a shopping excursion to settle his nerves before coming back to host his most significant party to date. He had reason to celebrate. The 30-year-old's new company, a Hong Kong outfit called Jinwell Capital, had just acquired a stake in EMI Music Publishing, whose hit-making writers included Kanye West, Beyoncé, Usher, Alicia Keys, and Pharrell Williams. On top of the EMI acquisition, Red Granite, the film company started by Low, Riza Aziz, and Joey McFarland, was set to begin filming work on The Wolf of Wall Street. Low, who had once been rejected for a personal bank account at Goldman in Switzerland, could now lay claim to being an entertainment mogul, and he wanted to make a splash. The Serene, with 15 guest cabins and dozens of crew members, was a floating pleasure palace, whose centerpiece was a huge whirlpool bath and bar on the top deck. Features included a sauna, a partially covered swimming pool, a lounge with a grand piano, and a twisting marble staircase connecting the multiple levels of the boat. When anchored, decks on hydraulic arms opened out over the water, permitting guests to dine al fresco. Low required the most sumptuous backdrop for the night's party, and Noah Tepperberg and Jason Strauss were on hand, as always, to oblige. The owners of the Marquee Nightclub had taken care of the details. The $330 million yacht, the ninth largest in the world when it was completed in 2011, belonged to Russian billionaire Yuri Scheffler, whose businesses included Stoli Vodka. Tepperberg and Strauss also flew out models from the United States, the glamorous nightclub hosts whom Lowe demanded at every party. Danny Abacaser, the club promoter and actor, brought along a group that included Leonardo DiCaprio, who was preparing to start filming The Wolf of Wall Street the following month. DiCaprio was known as a method actor, said to inhabit his characters' minds even when offset. The actor's hard-partying ways had been a tabloid fixture for years, so presumably it was not difficult for him to channel Jordan Belfort as he prepared for his next big role. And with Joe Lowe paying for the excesses, as he had done for years now, life and art began to fuse, even before the filming began. While Lowe and his entourage shopped in Monaco, Tepperberg and Strauss ensured everything was in place. Workers were putting the finishing touches to a stage on the boat for the night's performances. The guest list included some of the world's best-known pop stars: Kanye West, Rihanna, Chris Brown, Ludacris, as well as actors and members of Middle Eastern royal families. The $2.2 billion acquisition of EMI, finalized a month earlier, was led by Sony Music Holdings, the estate of Michael Jackson, and U.S. private equity giant Blackstone Group. Lowe's Jinwell Capital had invested alongside Mubadala, the Abu Dhabi fund run by Khaldun al-Mubarak. His share, just over $100 million, was by far his most legitimate-looking deal to date. Lowe had set up Jinwell with his brother Sen, and told financiers it was his family office, investing his grandfather's billions. His partners in the EMI deal had fallen for it. Lowe's share, in truth, was financed by the 1MDB bonds that Goldman had sold for the fund. To hide the origin of the money, Lowe used an old trick, getting his associate Fat Eric to set up an offshore shell company called Blackstone Asia Real Estate Partners. This firm was designed to look like a bona fide subsidiary of the Blackstone Group, but was controlled by Fat Eric, who worked for Lowe. On official documents, it would appear that Fat Eric owned scores of shell companies and assets, permitting Lowe to keep his involvement secret. By now, Lowe had siphoned off more than $1 billion of the 1MDB money generated by the bonds sold by Goldman Sachs. With the help of IPIC Managing Director Kadem Al-Kubaisi, Lowe had secured control of the cash, which was sitting in a shell company that looked like a subsidiary of IPIC. The money was supposedly to compensate IPIC for guaranteeing 1MDB's bonds, but it was now Lowe's to do with as he pleased. Looking for a way to fund his EMI stake, Lowe arranged for hundreds of millions of dollars to move to a Standard Chartered bank account of the lookalike Blackstone. To hide its traces, much of the money flowed through Amicorp-administered funds in Curaçao. From the money in the fake Blackstone account, Lowe financed Jinwell's stake in EMI, as well as paying off Al-Kubaisi, Jasmine Liu, the 1MDB legal counsel, and others. Soon after, Lowe became non-executive chairman Asia for EMI Music Publishing and joined the firm's advisory board. In an instant, the position at EMI gave him serious credentials in the music industry, elevating him from the status of a simple rich party boy and gambler. This was his big play. A media empire would generate profits to pay money back to 1MDB. In the first two stages of the heist, Lowe had simply taken about $3 billion and spent wildly. Now, he was aiming to build a real business with actual profits. Lowe had started Red Granite in 2010, but The Wolf of Wall Street would put the production company on the map. The film, coupled with the EMI deal, would, Lowe hoped, put to rest some of the questions that dogged him regarding his business interests and the source of his wealth. As Lowe arrived back on the boat with his shopping bags, the atmosphere was buzzing. Lowe was worried the gossip columnists, out in force around Saint-Tropez in the summer, would catch wind of what was going on. "Noah, need to manage press carefully," he wrote to Tepperberg. "Sony boss sent me an email and know about all the performances. Ha ha. I hope press doesn't know yet." The stars began to arrive on the Serene. Kate Upton, the American model, made a dramatic entrance on a helicopter. Amid a shower of sparklers, Lowe presented her with Hermes Birkin bags worth tens of thousands of dollars. Lowe told friends he craved the company of beautiful women, especially models, as if they validated his importance. In an intimate setting, he remained a reserved character, often at a loss for what to say. He was not even especially charming, but he reveled in being the center of female attention. There was a more practical element to the showmanship. As well as the stars, a number of Middle Eastern royals, including a Dubai prince, had come on board for the party. These royals had all the money in the world, but even they could not access the kind of crowd Lowe was able to muster. And the Malaysian understood that this was his edge. By delivering Hollywood to them, he was gaining prestige for himself with these powerful Middle Eastern figures, and, he hoped, opening the door to future deals. Punctuated by Kanye West's performance, the party raged until deep into the morning. The rap star was there with Kim Kardashian, his girlfriend, whose every move was noted by the press corps. Some gossip columnists did get wind of the party, focusing on the presence of West and Kardashian, as well as that of Chris Brown and Rihanna, who spent hours in conversation that evening despite his physical abuse of her 3 years earlier. Some newspapers even wrongly reported that Brown had rented the Serene. Lowe stayed out of the press. He could no longer afford the scrutiny of his dealings that press coverage would entail. No matter. Everything about the party was meant to indicate that Lowe had arrived. He could be content with the secret life of a powerful billionaire. As the party ratcheted down, most of the revelers left the boat, but a couple of dozen, including Lowe, his brother Sen, DiCaprio, the nightclub owners, and the bottle girls, stayed on. At 6 a.m., as the party finally fizzled, the super yacht pulled anchor and began to sail toward Portofino, the exclusive resort on the Italian island of Sardinia. While he was paying for their services, Lowe had always been polite with movie and music stars, but now the power balance began to shift. In April 2013, less than a year after the EMI deal, Lowe was hanging out in Jungle City Studios in Manhattan's Chelsea neighborhood, a place where Jay-Z, Rihanna, Nicki Minaj, and countless other stars had cut tracks. Lowe was there to record his own song for fun. His version of the soulful ballad, Void of a Legend. The song had been written by Antoinette Costa, a singer who recently had begun to date Joey McFarland. Lowe loved singing, but had a tuneless, high-pitched voice, and it took 8 hours and judicious use of auto-tune for Costa, working with a studio producer, to get an acceptable version in the can. As Lowe sang, friends, including McFarland and Swizz Beatz, came in and out of the recording booth. It was well into the evening when Busta Rhymes and Pharrell Williams, longtime clients of Jungle City, dropped by the studio where Lowe was now relaxing, a little inebriated. "Yo," Lowe called out to Busta Rhymes, ecstatic to see him. "I own you. You're my bitch." The comment, meant to be taken lightly, a playful reference to Lowe's EMI purchase, went over like a lead balloon. Busta Rhymes, a thick-set rapper, actor, and record producer, looked put out but stifled any remark, while Pharrell tried to cover up the embarrassment with small talk. Lowe was trying to act like a mogul, but he was awkward, an imposter who, for all his money, didn't quite fit the bill. Chapter 28. all the wealth in the world. New York, August 2012. On a Saturday in late August, Joey McFarland was sitting in his producer's chair in Manhattan's financial district. The neighborhood, quiet on a Saturday, had been taken over by the production of The Wolf of Wall Street. Martin Scorsese was directing a scene with Leonardo DiCaprio as Jordan Belfort and Kristen Milioti playing the role of Belfort's first wife. Sitting a block from the actual Wall Street, it was hard for McFarland to fathom how he got there. Less than 3 years after meeting Lowe in Whistler, and with basically zero film experience, here he was producing a movie with the biggest director and actor on the planet. Of all the people swept into his orbit, Joe Lowe helped change McFarland's situation more than anyone's. At 40 years old, McFarland had gone from a minor talent booker to a top-flight film producer. McFarland and his red granite partner Riza Aziz, the stepson of Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak, had not undertaken any apprenticeship in filmmaking and had released only one film, Friends with Kids, but they were now rubbing shoulders with professionals who had served for decades in the industry. For Scorsese and DiCaprio, these interlopers were a godsend. Not only did they control seemingly limitless cash, but they also permitted the pair boundless artistic freedom. When Scorsese wanted to crash a real white Lamborghini in the opening scenes of the movie, an event from Jordan Belfort's life, he was able to get red granite to foot the bill, even though most producers would have insisted on a replica for such purposes. As the money men, McFarland and Aziz's presence on set was tolerated. Back in Los Angeles, McFarland lived in a one-bedroom place in West Hollywood. Embarrassed by such a modest abode, he avoided inviting his movie star friends over. Now McFarland was residing in the Time Warner penthouse in New York with Joe Lowe. Moreover, McFarland had established himself as one of the Malaysians' closest friends. The pair became inseparable, traveling to the spa together, to Las Vegas to gamble, and on ski trips in the United States and Europe. McFarland began to rewrite his life story, airbrushing out his talent booking past. Hung up about his lack of experience, McFarland told interviewers that he'd been in and out of the film world for years, and prior to that, had worked in private equity. He made no mention of the Gyros restaurant in Cincinnati. Film industry professionals, including those working for Red Granite, considered him a parvenu. Despite his humble origins, McFarland had become the face of Red Granite. Riza was shy and was not in the office much, preferring to play or watch tennis while the American enjoyed the limelight. Lowe stayed off the set, worried about attracting press coverage. After earlier telling Red Granite employees that Lowe was the financier, McFarland now took to saying the money came from the Middle East. Lowe had taken pains to ensure this fiction might stand up to some scrutiny. Red Granite Capital, a company owned by Riza Aziz, had received more than $200 million from the bonds arranged by Goldman. This money had initially moved into a shell company controlled by Al-Kubaisi of IPIC and his employee, Mohammed Al-Husseini. As filming began, Al-Husseini began to hang around the Red Granite offices and attend screenings, as if he represented the money behind the production. The cash received by Red Granite Capital went to finance The Wolf of Wall Street, as well as to pay for Riza's acquisition of properties in Los Angeles, New York, and London from Lowe, the bulk of the homes Lowe had acquired 2 years earlier. In public, the Red Granite executives were coy about financing. McFarland refused to tell a reporter from The Hollywood Reporter about funding, while Riza vaguely explained that money came from investors in the Middle East and Asia. Although he kept his name out of the press and avoided the set, Lowe continued to deepen his relationship with DiCaprio as filming progressed. At one point during production, the Malaysian spent more than a week at the Venetian in Las Vegas, accompanied at times by DiCaprio, Riza, and McFarland. He told friends he liked the quietness of the gambling floor, where cell phones are prohibited, as it allowed him to escape. The paid-for gambling excursions also helped reel in the actor. The Red Granite executives were hoping for a long-running collaboration. In the fall of 2012, McFarland had dinner at Le Bernardin, a top French restaurant in Manhattan, with DiCaprio and South Korean director Park Chan-wook, to discuss another possible film project. Lo, Risa, and McFarland also began to mimic aspects of DiCaprio's lifestyle. An avid collector of movie posters, the actor introduced Risa to Ralph DeLuca, a New Jersey-based dealer in film memorabilia. And the Red Granite principals began to use money taken from the 1MDB funds to acquire millions of dollars in collectibles from him. In October 2012, Risa paid DeLuca the staggering sum of $1.2 million for an original film poster for Fritz Lang's 1927 silent film, Metropolis, which he hung in his private office at Red Granite. McFarland wanted to go one better. "What is the greatest poster in the world that is obtainable?" McFarland asked DeLuca in an email. Over the next 18 months, McFarland and Aziz would arrange to buy more than 70 items from DeLuca at a cost of over $4 million, plastering the walls of the Red Granite offices and Risa's Park Laurel condominium in New York with posters. McFarland sent DeLuca and Risa lists of posters he wanted to collect. "I have decided I have to own these. It's a must. Not to mention a 1,000 others. Can't sleep. Obsessing," he wrote. "Ha ha ha. Now you feel my pain. Mwah ha 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 ha. Dollar sign, dollar sign, dollar sign, dollar sign," Risa replied. "I'm obsessing over posters. We are such neurotic, obsessive creatures. We have to own them all," McFarland retorted. As DiCaprio got closer to Lo and McFarland, the friends even went to view mansions together. On September 20th, 2012, the actor forwarded a confidentiality agreement from his broker at Sotheby's to McFarland. The agreement gave the signer the right to view a property situated on 658 Nimes Road in Bel Air that was on the market for a staggering $150 million. The owner was a Saudi sheikh. Not wanting the publicity, Lo used McFarland as a front, and the American signed as the prospective buyer. Lo and McFarland toured the property, one of the most expensive in the United States, comprising multiple houses clustered around a central driveway on 40,000 square feet of land, with more than 28 bedrooms and more than 30 bathrooms, in addition to an infinity pool with views over Los Angeles, a gym, a spa, and a cinema. Despite almost 3 years of incessant acquisitions, Lo was not sated. He'd offloaded his Hollywood mansion to Risa Aziz and was now looking for a palace fit for a billionaire. Like William Randolph Hearst, whose castle at San Simeon in California remains a symbol of the excess of the early 20th century, Lo yearned for the most opulent property conceivable. In the end, Lo did not make the acquisition. He bid $80 million for the property, but the Saudi sheikh rejected the offer. There were some things, although not many, that even Lo could not afford. On November 17, 2012, Lo and Risa entered the Monkey Bar in the Hotel Elysee in Midtown Manhattan, an establishment with red leather sofas and booths that created an old-vibe Hollywood feel. The place, owned by Vanity Fair editor Graydon Carter, was popular with Midtown lawyers and bankers, as well as movie and media types. As glasses of champagne were handed around, the Red Granite principals mingled with Hollywood A-listers, from DiCaprio and Daniel Day-Lewis to Harvey Keitel and Steven Spielberg. The guests had assembled for Martin Scorsese, who was turning 70. He was deep in the filming of The Wolf of Wall Street, which had been pushed off schedule by Hurricane Sandy in late October. He'd been told only a few close friends were attending his birthday celebration, but there were some 120 people in the bar, which had been rented out for the evening. The celebration included a montage of blooper clips from Scorsese movies, a four-course meal, and a champagne toast to the director. As a birthday gift, Lo had sent Scorsese a Polish-language version of the movie poster for Cabaret. In an old-fashioned typewritten note, Scorsese later thanked Lo for the amazing gifts. "The very rare Polish language poster made my 70th all the more special." This period was the high water mark of Lo's influence in Hollywood. Only 2 weeks earlier, Lowe had hosted his own birthday party, the circus-themed extravaganza that would go down in Las Vegas lore as the most expensive private party ever held, the details of which opened this book. The evening featured an indoor Ferris wheel, circus performers, and a who's who of Hollywood, not to mention Britney Spears emerging from a fake birthday cake. All of Lowe's contacts attended. Not just the stars like DiCaprio, but also Tim Leissner, Al Husseini, and other Lowe business associates. Almost everyone who had played a role in facilitating Lowe's triumph was on hand to celebrate with him. Lowe arranged for every aspect of the event to be paid from the 1MDB bonds, and the amounts were staggering. For an evening's work, Swizz Beatz, Lowe's producer friend and husband of Alicia Keys, received $800,000 from a shell company funded from the stolen money. This was peak Joe Lowe. The filming of The Wolf of Wall Street was nearly over. He was at the height of his powers, and the celebrations were so frequent they practically blurred together. A few days after the Vegas party, Lowe, Aziz, and McFarland presented DiCaprio with an unforgettable present for his 38th birthday on November 11th. There was buzz around The Wolf of Wall Street. DiCaprio had been delivering some electrifying scenes, and photos were leaking online. The producers talked about the possibility of him finally winning an Oscar. As a gift, they managed to secure Marlon Brando's Best Actor statuette from the 1954 film On the Waterfront, a nod to DiCaprio that he was overdue for one himself. Years earlier, the statuette had gone missing from Brando's Hollywood home. And despite an Academy bylaw that prohibits the sale of Oscars, it had ended up with De Luca, who charged $600,000 for it. DiCaprio was intrigued by Brando, whose progressive politics led him to reject another Oscar in 1973 in protest at the depiction of Native Americans in film. DiCaprio, too, had become politically outspoken, campaigning for the land rights of indigenous people in North America over corporate interests, and drawing attention to how climate change was endangering their way of life. Over Christmas that year, McFarland had a hamper of caviar from Petrosian, a favorite of Scorsese's, sent to the director and his wife's townhouse on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and he spent $2,245 of company money on a bottle of Cristal Rose Champagne for Scorsese at the Wolf of Wall Street rap party, held at Marquee, the New York nightclub owned by Tepperberg and Strauss of the Strategic Group. Despite the producer's lavish gift, when Scorsese passed McFarland in the lobby of the Time Warner building, the director didn't seem to recognize him. As he did for all his films, Scorsese sent keychains to everyone as his rap gift. Whatever the men's personal dynamic, even before filming was finished, Riza and McFarland were attending readings with Scorsese for The Irishman, a film project involving Robert De Niro that was next on the director's slate. And Red Granite was attempting to line up DiCaprio to headline a remake of Papillon, the 1970s Steve McQueen hit movie. Still, after this season of celebration, as filming wrapped up toward the end of December, Lowe and DiCaprio hadn't had their fill of partying. The Malaysian had one more treat for the cast and other friends. A Boeing 747-400 can hold around 600 passengers, but the VIP-configured model Lowe had chartered, with plush reclining seats, was a more spacious alternative for the 40 or so people who boarded in Los Angeles at the end of December. Atlas Air rented these kinds of planes to professional sports teams or Saudi princes. The cost of chartering such an aircraft was in the tens of thousands of dollars per hour. The guests included Jamie Foxx, Kevin Connolly, Jonah Hill, Leonardo DiCaprio, and a handful of models. On the plane, Lowe and McFarland were as inseparable as ever. The group was heading to Sydney, Australia, where they spent a couple of days partying on yachts, gambling, and eating. On one yacht, DiCaprio, a black baseball cap turned backward, took a shot at DJing, while Fox, dressed in a buttoned-up white shirt and black jacket, danced. Beautiful women in short black dresses milled around the dance floor. One rich Thai friend of Lowe's, Shavayos Ratakul, posted a picture on his Instagram of gambling chips on the floor of the Star, a casino overlooking Sydney's Darling Harbour. A good way to waste $1 million, he wrote in the caption. In the casino complex, a marquee nightclub recently had opened, owned by Tepperberg and Strauss. For the group's New Year's Eve celebration in the club, Lowe had ordered ice baths to be filled with scores of bottles of Cristal champagne. Showtime, Swizz Beatz wrote on Instagram. After the stroke of midnight, the group got back on the Boeing 747-400 for a 15-hour flight to Las Vegas. After crossing the international date line and being picked up by stretch limousines, the partygoers made for Lavo, a nightclub also co-owned by Tepperberg and Strauss, ready for yet another New Year's countdown. Perhaps in an effort to sustain the group for a few more hours of partying, Lowe ordered buckets of KFC chicken. Dressed in a red shirt with black pants and sports sneakers, Lowe at one point took a swig of champagne directly from the bottle. Someone put on a fake panda head. As midnight approached for the second time that day, models danced on the bar, holding champagne bottles lit with sparklers. The KFC was popular, but nobody really drank the champagne, preferring to spray it around the room, as if they had finally had their fill after years. Only JL can manage this for double countdowns 2013, Chavayos boasted. Jamie Foxx, who by now had known Lowe for 3 years, was no stranger to outrageous parties. He'd been there for Lowe's birthday in Las Vegas only 2 months earlier, but even he was excited by the self-gratification of the past few days. He told British talk show host Jonathan Ross about the party, but like almost everyone who knew Lowe well, he kept the Malaysian's name out of the story, sensing he didn't need the publicity. I got a friend, you know, he got some money, and he flew me, Leonardo DiCaprio, Jonah Hill, and some other cats, and we flew to Australia, right? And we did the countdown in Australia, then jumped back on a plane, and then did the countdown in Vegas. That's crazy. That was nuts. Chapter 29. Mystique of the Orient. Singapore, November 2012. Lowe's focus on partying might have made him appear carefree, but his attitude belied turmoil behind the scenes. Just days after his birthday extravaganza in Las Vegas, Joe Lowe faced a roadblock. He was trying to send $110 million from his BSI account in Singapore to a trust he controlled at another bank, Rothschild in Zurich, to finance the purchase of a mansion on Oriole Drive in the Bird Streets area of the Hollywood Hills. After the Saudi sheikh rejected Lowe's offer for the Nimes property, Lowe had agreed to pay $39 million for a Mexican-style home, double the previous record for a house in the Hollywood Hills, a trendy enclave near Red Granite's Sunset Strip offices and close to DiCaprio's place. Lowe planned to spend millions more to tear down the older home and construct a white-themed modernistic mansion with 18,000 square feet of living space, 2 swimming pools, and a go-kart track in the basement. But compliance executives at the Swiss bank BSI, finally, were causing problems. Ahead of the intended transfer, Lowe's BSI account had received the money from Goodstar, his Seychelles company, before he sent it to his father, Larry, who then routed it back to Lowe, all within the same day. As with his purchase of the Time Warner penthouse, the purpose of these circuitous transactions was to make Rothschild bankers believe Lowe had received the money from his father. By then putting it into a trust at Rothschild, Lowe was attempting to make it appear as if the Bird Streets mansion was part of the Lowe family's estate, held in trust for future generations. He did the same with many assets. BSI's compliance department could see behind the scenes. In an email, a banker charged with rooting out fraud at BSI wrote to Yaqiu Qi and other senior managers that the frenetic movements of cash from Goodstar to Lowe to his father and back to Lowe was nebulous to say the least and not acceptable in compliance's view. The family wealth story was facing some scrutiny. Lowe was determined to find a way around the compliance officers, whose concerns had been relayed to him by Yak. In the pre-dawn hours of the night, he began to type furiously. In an email to BSI management, Lowe explained that the money he wanted to transfer to Switzerland originally had been a gift he sent to his father. The money, Lowe explained, was a mark of respect to his elders, a cornerstone of Confucianism. When good wealth creation is generated, as a matter of cultural respect and good fortune that arises from respect, we always give our parents the proceeds. This is part of our custom and culture. In the email, Lowe explained that, per custom, it was up to the elders in question to decide what to do with the gift. In this case, my father receives it as a token of gesture, respect, and appreciation, and decides to give it back to me for me to then subsequently provide a portion for the benefit of my family trust. He then chided the Swiss bankers for their cultural naivete. I hope this clarifies, as this is culturally sensitive, and it would be taboo and bad luck otherwise, and our family is very particular about respect of the elderly and being appreciative to family. This bastardized picture of Chinese culture in no way adequately explained the need for such shady transfers. But Lowe had another card to play. He knew BSI had become dependent on his business, and faced with the prospect of losing it, would go to lengths to keep the money flowing. I hope I do not need to keep explaining the same matter over and over again, as our time is better spent generating wealth so that the AUM, assets under management, in BSI Bank can be increased as opposed to providing answers for questions which have already been provided for previously. I fully understand and respect the requirement of compliance, but one should not be overburdening your customers, especially when they have been addressed in the past. At 2:10 a.m. on November 7th, Lowe clicked send, firing off the email to a number of top BSI managers in Singapore. Ordinary folks often get questioned by their banks for small transfers of money. But billionaires are not ordinary. By this point, Lowe already was by far the biggest client that BSI had anywhere in the world, and he was making a lot of people in the bank richer than they ever could have hoped. He was referred to as Big Boss in the bank's Singapore offices, and senior BSI executives would join him for parties in Las Vegas and on yachts. The bank's senior executives would do all they could to keep Lowe's business. Within days of Lowe's email, BSI's top executives approved the $110 million transfer. Intra-family transfers are not always going to be logical, a senior BSI banker wrote in response to the compliance officer's concerns. Days later, though, bankers at Rothschild, where the money ended up, wanted more details about the origins of so much cash. Lowe realized they would not be as easy to fool as BSI. And so, on November 20th, he wrote Yock requesting he send a letter to a senior Rothschild banker, vouching for the source of funds. Lowe himself drew up the letter, which stressed BSI had known the Lowe family for years and had extensive compliance procedures. The contents made it appear the money came from Larry Lowe, even though the original source of funds was Goodstar and 1MDB. By this time, Yock was entirely in Lowe's pocket. He had begun to let other clients drop and spent 90% of his time on Lowe's account, following him around the world on private jets and attending his yacht parties. As Yock seemingly became addicted to the money and jet-set lifestyle, Lowe was able to get him to do almost anything he asked. Alarmed, a female subordinate of Yock's advised him to ensure proper compliance procedures were met. If you guys are so scared, then don't be private bankers. Private bankers must take some risks. If not, go back and breastfeed your children, he retorted angrily. Yock secretly signed and sent the letter to Rothschild on BSI's official letterhead, without getting approval from his managers and legal department, as dictated by the bank's compliance procedures. The letter assuaged any concerns Rothschild's bankers had harbored. Lowe, it appeared, was succeeding in blotting out the past, and with Yock's help, embellishing the story that he had grown up with billions. But Yock had stepped over the gray line that in private banking divides the merely unseemly from the illegal. It was a misstep for which Yock would pay, and a sign of the risks Lowe was running. As the fear of detection consumed him, Lowe's attempts at subterfuge could appear almost comical. He set up a Gmail account under the name of Eric Tan, his associate known as Fat Eric, and began to use it, trying to hide his involvement in deals. When he wanted to open an account with the Abar Control